Politica culturali, Mihai Karsten Schwierer. Insemmilkom nilqalkom għal programm ieħor fis-sensiela il-politika kulturali Mihai Karsten Schwierer. Hemm kif drajtu oramaj minn ġimgħa ġimgħa ikolli mistiedna jew mistednin illi flimkien nipprova niftaħ ftit ieħor hemm din id-dinja tal-politika kulturali dejjem b'din mistoqsija tiegħi ta' x'inhi r-relevanza għax hemm relevanza għal suġġett tal-politika kulturali. Meta ħafna drabi il-politika ssir jekk il-flus bħala aspetti oħra ta' ħajjitha fil-verità u forsi iktar minn visjoni jew direzzjoni jew strateġija hemm bżonn li ċertu realtajiet tas-soċjetà tagħna fil-varjetà, fil-multikulturaliżmu, fis-sfidi li tiffaċċja minħabba l-iżvilupp, il-bini, pressjonijiet fuq is-soċjetà tagħna forsi li xi darba kien qed mod jew niftakruha mod u naħsbu fija li kien qed mod u issa forsi bi żmien narawha li sarra differenti. Forsi bċertu drabi għakib sens ta' nostalġija jew ta' soba li tlifna xaħġa li ġidarba kellna, għacċem lok għal diskussjoni u għal forsi xi azzjonijiet, xi ideat li jistgħu iwasslu għal ċertu tibdil jew ċertu pjanijiet u għalhekk politika. Li tista' b'xi mod ħares lej mhux biss Malta bħala pajjiżi, imma l-komunitajiet differenti, realtajiet differenti. U anke Malta mhux waħedha imma fil-kuntest Mediterran, Ewropew u anke globali. Qabel ma nintroduċi l-mistiden tal-lum illi propju f'dan il-suġġett ta' identità passat u preżent jidħol feles, nerġa' nfakkarkom illi programm ixandar fuq Campus FM tistgħu tisimgħu anke fuq il-podcast online. U nirringrazzja mill-ġdid Sandro Zerafa illi flimkien ma' Vincent Bourget, Jonin Zelnik u Antoine Paganotti għamil din il-mużika għal dan il-program, għamil din il-mużika possibli dan huwa l-album Last Night Minn Very Young li rrekordja aktar kmini fil-bidu ta' din is-sena ġewwa Pariġi u nsellmu lil Sandro minn hawnhekk. Jiġi għal mistieden tiegħi llum li huwa Joshua De Giorgio. Joshua, hello and welcome and thank you for accepting an invitation to this program.
Thank you, Carsten, thank you for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
Għal-faċilità ta' komunikazzjoni u sa anke mill-biografija ta' Joshua tifhmu fil-Italjan ħankunu qed nagħmlu t-taħdita tagħna bl-Ingliż kif ġieli nagħmlu f'dan il-programm qed ikolna mistiedin. Pajjiżi differenti jew anke l-lingwa u l-espressjoni tagħhom tuża forsi b'mod iktar qawwir sieħ il-lingwa Ingliża jew lingwa oħra ġieli. Joshua, in your case, it's one of those particular happy, interesting, curious mixes I've come across in this program. In all over three series we'll have spoken to around more than 40 people. And in your case, however, there's something again, particular, different. At the moment, you're a PhD researcher with the University of York in the UK within the Department of Archaeology. And maybe that's when cool. I say that, listeners might say, archaeology, okay, then it's about heritage, then it's about tangible, maybe a bit of intangible. But over the last few years, when we've spoken about sort of comparing notes sometimes in our research, and also comparing our notes with other people who we know in common, or we discovered to know in common, within a small maybe community of people who are part archaeologists, part historians, part cultural memorists, field work which takes people in particular territories and particular communities. And in your case, one of the things which is particularly interesting, that you seem to combine a number of aspects, maybe stemming from research which is sort of archaeologically bent, But it reminds me more of the archaeology of knowledge that the French philosopher about 40, 50 years ago spoke about, Michel Foucault, who sort of mining and digging into not only sort of what lies around us or what used to lie around us, but also within people's memories or what they think they remember or what they interpret as having been their part. Because sometimes we build and we imagine sometimes we sort of fill in gaps, fill in holes by maybe recreating some stories and changing them a little bit. A bit what Benedict Anderson said in the 80s about sort of building imagined communities. And in our case, there are many of these aspects which makes our work very, very interesting. Could you maybe just share a few views of even how correct or far from correct I've been in this introduction?
No, I would say you are correct. I'm coming at heritage, like you say, from a sort of an archaeological background, but that was 20 years ago. So I've come at it renewed to do, you know, sort of my midlife crisis academic reattempt at life. But yeah, so heritage in from my perspective is it goes beyond the simply the, you know, the tangible, which is, you know, the obvious, no less important, of course. I mean, we're surrounded by it all over but it's more about people's valuation of that heritage and their interaction with it and how that might be different. And how that fits in with other, you know, with other larger narratives, because you've got so many different things at play here. So I'm coming at it looking at basically possibly a tension between what I would call an official understanding of what heritage is and what people might consider their heritage. And that ties in with lots of things, both tangible and intangible. And of course, Foucault and all the French theorists do come into it, although it gives, every time I hear the word or the name, I start to panic because I find him impenetrable. But I do realize he is, without his work and his way of understanding, you know, knowledge and power, dichotomies and that sort of thing, a lot of this sort of archaeological theory of the early 80s, what is known as post-processualism, you know, has a strong link to that sort of thought. And so naturally, I'm coming at it on the basis of that, on the shoulders of those sort of, theorists from the French.
For us not to be as impenetrable or even slightly so with regards to our listeners,
to keep our
discussion as accessible as possible. Obviously, there are all these layers, and one when one sort of enters fields of studies, as do people at university, even University of Malta, which hosts this station and this program, and maybe some of our listeners as well, through bachelor's, master's, PhDs, obviously have to go deep and delve and sort of, in a way, challenge what they're listening to and reading. And in your case, in spite of COVID and all the restrictions that you have met over the past few years, so between York and elsewhere in the UK, Valletta, from where you are speaking to me now, and other travels you've engaged with, however, the issue of tangible and intangible, which I mention often in this program, sort of between what we see around us as buildings, as structures, many times in Malta, related to Neolithic temples or all the buildings we see around us from the time of the Knights of St. John or the British period, somehow changed and modified and sometimes degraded or sometimes adapted because of contemporary use. And within all that, however, you also look at, or especially you look at people and how they live those spaces. And I know that because of your particular interests and practice also in the field of music, which in a way is a big gelling agent, sort of a great glue. In another program recently, Michael Bergoglio said something similar because of his affinity with music and the musical field in Malta. Somehow, sort of those two worlds come together, and you've shone a light on that.
Well, I come at this. I mean, originally I had trained in the field of historical archaeology, which is what I originally did. So they were looking at the sort of archaeology of the post-medieval world. And I looked at Malta, but this was a long time ago, and I just thought Malta would be a perfect place for that sort of study because we have all these unique sort of strange colonial experiences that sort of don't fit in the norm. And I thought, you know, we could maybe be a new kind of way of looking at Malta using the tools that historical archaeology provided, intellectual tools, and using that sort of archaeological eye or gaze to you know, look at issues of identity and that sort of thing. And I still think that's a valid way of looking at it. And I know there's been some recent work. But 20 years later, I went back to university and, you know, totally fresh start, and things had obviously changed. And I was very fortunate enough, and this was totally, you know, serendipitous, it wasn't something I planned, that at the University of York, the head of the department was, and my current supervisor is Professor John Schofield, who actually has a relationship with Malta. And one of his research interests, of which he has very many, is specifically heritage and music and how they interact. And when we were discussing sort of ideas of where I could take, this is my MA research, what we could do, we were looking at Valletta, we were looking at Straight Street, which is one of his particular interests. He's actually published a book on that in 2013, I believe. I was thinking about that and debating that, but something just popped in my mind. And it was a memory of, since I live in Valletta and I walk around the city, I was just looking at the Tignier development, and you can see the fort and you can see that luxurious high rise. And I grew up around that area because I used to skateboard, and it was at the time, so it would have been sort of late, it would have been late 80s, early 90s. It was the very end of a scene that used to exist there when Tignier was still very run down after the British had left. There was a music scene. There was a thriving music scene, a community of up to 30 bands at one point, I believe, which is forgotten. I mean, apart from in the memories of the people who actually, you know, were part of that community. I happen to remember it. Michael Bregulio was actually, you know, inspired to play music, which you know, is a fabulous musician, because his sister used to play there. So there's all these strange connections.
All these intricacies and connections.
Yes, yes.
Joshua, before we delve deeper, mm-hmm. Let's just have a brief musical interview from Sandro Giraffe again. And then come back into a bit more detail about this very fascinating thing. Thank you. Nemmek għallejna silta mużikali oħra minn ħata Sandro Zirafa u l-ensemble tiegħu. U ta' dan nirringrazzjah biex niġu għal diskussjoni fuq il-mużika. Jum qed nitkellem ma' Joshua De Giorgio, riċerkatur fid-dottorat tiegħu ġewwa l-Università ta' York l-Ingilterra mid-Dipartiment tal-Arkeoloġija, miegħu nitkellem fuq aspetti u perspettivi fi differenti forsi għall-arkeologija u l-istudji tal-istorja milli forsi iktar imdorrin li tkellmu u nisimgħu dwarhom. Joshua, before the pause, you were just opening up a little bit more about your research in the 10-year scene,
yep.
80s, in between developments. So I remember my aunts and uncles living in the social housing, which had developed within the barracks, yep. There in the 80s, before the development, which then sort of overtook the whole land, is still going on today. Yes. And somehow, what struck me from what you said, and also previous conversations we've said, is that somehow these memories live on, and many people today, even in their 50s or their 60s, had a very formative experience there. But somehow, there's a memory which is a bit misty and a bit very actually intangible. But unless one sort of tries to speak to people, try to record experiences, try to gain access to photographs maybe or some video material, and also interestingly visits, which you have done, visit the site, so Tinier Tower, obviously not the way it was because you can't go back in time in a certain way, but you can by trying to identify particular spaces, spots within that geography of the place,
yep.
Which has changed incredibly in a number of years, but somehow you are trying to tap into. So my question would be, is that so, and also why?
Well, what struck me about it was it's so symbolic of this sort of changing mortar. We have this sort of 18th century fort, and we have this brand new shiny development. And some of the ideas I was coming across when I started university again was this notion of the sort of tension between ideas of what heritage is and officially. So we have this restored fort sitting there. It's empty, by the way. It's fully restored because I visited it. It's cleaned up. It's, you know, and if you've ever seen a picture of what Tinier looked like in the 80s, I mean, it was run down. It had graffiti. It had, you know, the bands hanging out. And I thought this is a really good example of how the space has been reused. It's not being reused because it was a fort of the, you know, the Knights of St. John or because of its connection to the British. It's being reused and important to this community for a whole different whole set of reasons. And I found that really interesting. So for them, what I wanted to do, and it worked out well, and they were amazing to work with, was just say, okay, let's speak to some of the people who were there and see what it was that was important to them. Was it the, you know, the aura of sort of historic aura that might surround the fort, the aesthetic? And the reason why I'm using these words is because these are very commonly what our heritage values are linked to buildings and whatnot. You know, it's historic. It's aesthetically pleasing. It may provide sort of evidential values in terms of what it tells us about the past. Those things all remain true. But to this community that lived there for 10 years, none of that was particularly important. It was the memories they associate with it. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, long stories. It's a social geography. So I tried to capture that because I thought it'd be an interesting way of just looking at how we might provide an alternative view on how heritage spaces are used. And I think it was quite successful. It was a project I really enjoyed doing, and the community were really forthcoming, and they have wonderful archives themselves, personal archives of photos, and I captured those, and it was the result of my thesis, essentially. Mm-hmm.
And you've said sort of the methodology you've adopted, mm-hmm. somehow encourages an alternative take on our heritage. And I think walking through places like Tinier, but not only, yeah. You've got Paletta, you've got some areas, you know, like in Cotonera, so Burgu, but also Isla, where you've got sort of change, development, which has been going on for the last 500 years, at least,
yeah.
But of a particular kind, which is, as you said, sort of clean, shiny, one might describe it within the big world of gentrification, where the commercial and financial interest has given a particular set of values and maybe made others less important, more redundant. This social spirit of, as you said, of people coming together, not maybe worrying so much as to where they are and how they are interacting with the space, but more of creating a dynamic, a vibrant environment. And this has been a process which has been going on in Malta, but in many other places. I remember the first time I went to Berlin about 20 years ago, I got that feeling of seeing historical places alive, thriving, maybe not in ways which a heritage curator would have wanted, but definitely with a live use, if it was a tower, the remains of a castle, but even industrial heritage, so buildings from the 60s and the 70s, which had become maybe car parks or whatever. And I had the same experience in my few years living in Brussels, for example, where there's this great use of space. But somehow, I find it less preoccupied. In Malta, we seem to be more preoccupied with resale value, cleaning it up, pushing it up on the real estate market. And again, land is at a premium, I understand that. But even in other places, land is always important. You don't waste an inch. But there seems to be other ways of interacting with this environment and with this heritage. And while you spoke of alternative ways of approaching these spaces, I was thinking of also complementary ways. So in a way, it's not sort of either or.
No,
it's
certainly
this
not.
Or that. It can
no,
be a mix.
It can be a mix. I mean, you can't deny, you don't want to deny the fact that buildings have a sort of, I don't like to use the word, but let's call it a sort of innate historical value. Just for simplification, it's a problematic word and some, you know, it can be debated. But something it's what I'm looking at currently, because when I moving on to my doctoral thesis, I basically said, what I want to do is, the conversation I had with my supervisor, he said, would you like to do a doctorate? I said, yeah, possibly. And he said, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'll expand on my MA. Mm-hmm. He said, yep, that sounds good. And by expanding on the MA, because the MA was really specific and it was really about capturing those stories, it didn't really ask some of the bigger questions, you know, why is it that, why is it that we treat it this way? What could be, you know, so there are all these larger pictures, like you said, and I don't want to be too cynical, because I can be, and it's quite easy to be in Malta to be too cynical reasons. You know, heritage is simply commodified. We're only doing it to please the other heritage value, which is economic value. And I remember, and it comes back to a conversation you and I had, which was about heritage being disconnected from the population. And it very, and a lot of this, these ideas stem from Ruben Grima's 1998 paper, which was about the vandalization of the temples, where he was asking the question, why are we disconnected from this heritage? And I just wondered, what is our relationship to our heritage? And obviously I can't answer all the questions, so I have chosen for my doctoral thesis to look specifically at Valletta and to look at just how people relate to the city. And I think it's a good test case. It's fairly small. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, yet another one of those, you know, very strong, official kind of internationally recognized parameters that heritage seeks. It's changing a lot. As you know, you work there, I live here. So it ticks all those boxes. I think that's where I'm getting to now, is where I'm going to be asking those questions on a larger date.
If I have to sort of jump the gun a bit, and also because we're just a few minutes away from concluding in the last 2 minutes already, what are you observing as to the relationship between the different communities that use and live in Valletta and the different spaces? But also keeping in mind the pandemic that Valletta has gone through. There's a number of shopkeepers who luckily are still open who say that since November 2019, after the protests in front of Parliament in Valletta, and since then and onwards, there's been a bit of a damper over Valletta. And then obviously after March 2020 with COVID, everything sort of seems to have quieted down. And somehow that can sound bad, but some people also seem to have rediscovered certain places which were maybe out of bounds a bit before or not used or disregarded.
Well, it's easier to navigate around an empty city, right? and Valletta is very much, and sadly so, very empty, and it's going to be struggling. I haven't actually started, so my observations are strictly, you know, my own at the moment. I haven't actually started. I'm still waiting on approval to begin my interview phases, which will probably be conducted this summer. I'm really not sure what to expect. I know what I'd like to expect, although that's really bad practice. but I'm hoping to be surprised. I'm hoping for what I'm. It's more about what I hope for at the moment. I'm hoping for a good mix. I'm hoping for people sharing stories about, you know, personal memories of certain shops, of places, of street corners, of events. It's a bit like the Magnus Lin project, which I think is excellent. And so I'm doing this on an interviewing basis when I'm, you know, meeting people from different, who have different relationships to Valletta. So that's also very important to my research.
Yeah.
So I don't know, Carsten. I'm very excited to see what will actually come of it.
Yes, and I think you're at a good place to do that, even though leaving the door open to be surprising, to want to be surprised. I think it's really good, because if you already have all the answers before, what's the point?
Exactly. No, I think there should be space for that. You know, I've got to keep a clear mind and hopefully just, you know, interview a broad enough group of people that I get a really good different sense of how people view the city.
Very good. Joshua, I'm afraid our time's up. You mentioned, you're not the first one to mention the project Magnus Lin. Led by Andrew Alamango, actually, in this series, because somehow through culture, through discussion about archives and memory, especially, people do, yes, travel back and forth in time, but somehow also look into the future.
He was also a Tenier participant, just saying, more networks.
So that's great. Yeah. Joshua, let's leave you there for today. I thank you very much for having me for the discussion. And grazie a lil Joshua De Giorgio. Li kemm irriċerkati hawn kif smajtu fuq ħafna aspetti forsi kif tiddifferenti mis-soltu relatati mal-patrimonju u issa dinkom tkunu għana għal-programm kor il-ġimgħa li jiena. Insemmikom.